from the twisted realm of science and the darkest pits of reason comes chilling tales of godlessness. Bear witness to the unfathomable terror that is the Good Atheist.
Welcome to the Good Atheist Podcast. My name is Jacob Vortan.
My name is Johnny Scaramanga.
Now, today you're going to notice that there is a bit of a weird name here. Who is this young man who is talking to you right now? Who is Johnny Scaramanga? And, you know, throughout the show, we're going to be answering that question. But before we begin, I want to mention one thing. Now, some of you may be aware of this because I've posted this on the site before, and I've recorded shows, and by now all of you should be kind of caught up to the big news that eventually... And I guess the key word here is eventually, I will be stepping down as the main Good Atheist, at least from the podcast. And what I'm doing ever so slowly is that I'm bringing other people into the fold that have things that they want to talk about, that have, you know, issues that they want to bring up. Because as far as I'm concerned, my own passion when it comes to the scene has, I will admit, begun to dwindle. I think it's just because I'm becoming an old man. You know, slowly but surely. And therefore, I thought that, you know, since the platform is still there, and since there's so many talented people out there that have opinions and thoughts and want to contribute to the whole atheist activism thing, I thought, well, why don't I become kind of like a lightning rod? Why don't I go out and find people that are talented and then just say, come with me and I will show you all of the things that you need to know in order to make a good show. I don't even know why I have an accent right now. It's stupid.
And you couldn't find any talented people, so you've got me on instead.
Well, unfortunately, you know, it's harder than it looks. But the first thing I want to do, Johnny, is I want to tell everybody who you are. And actually, no, I'm going to let you tell everyone who you are so that, you know, because the thing is, this is a little bit like your audition. You know, I don't know if you know this, but as far as everyone's concerned, who's listening to this, they have to approve of you. If I get a whole bunch of fucking emails that are telling me, I don't like this kid, kick him off the show, I got bad news for you. So, first of all, why should anyone give a shit about you, Johnny?
Christ, no pressure. All right, I am Johnny Scaramanga, international supervillain, rock star, and fighter of the forces of evil. And I grew up as a Christian fundamentalist, and I was one of those crazy creationists that you find on the forums telling you that the world is only 6,000 years old and you can trace back modern kings back to Noah to prove this, and that, like, monsters are still alive in the world today because dinosaurs survived Noah's flood and they're just living in secret in jungles out there. I was that guy. And now I've come over to the side of people who think rationally and sanely, and I'm here to help you engage with creationists.
Well, I think I actually saw a video of you, which I'm going to post. Hopefully it won't be too embarrassing, of a young you. I think you're maybe like 9 or 10 or something like that, and you were in a video trying to convince the world that the Earth was 6,000 years old. Does this sound familiar?
There are a couple of things like that out there. Yeah, when I was a kid, the BBC got hold of me and I made a few little programs for them explaining how everyone was going to hell unless they believed what I believed. And some of them are out there. Some of them I've released into the wild on YouTube.
And you're not... How embarrassed by these videos are you, by the way?
I'm actually now really proud of them. I was so embarrassed of them for years, and it was like this dirty secret that I had. And then I realized, well, wait, this wasn't my fault. I was a kid, and this is just what, like, adults that should have known better were forcing into me, and that's why I believed this stuff. So now I'm like, look, I escaped from this, but this is like a warning to other people. And yeah, I beat them. Every time I watch those videos, it's like, yeah, you fuckers, you tried to lie to me, and I beat you.
Well, I think it's kind of, you know, for those of you that are not native of the Isles, let's say, he's got an adorable accent. He's like, you know, I always thought that if I had a kid, I'd move over to England because I want my kids to have, you know, fucking adorable British accents, which is what you have when you're just talking about utter nonsense. I mean, it's still fascinating. Maybe it's just me and, you know, the fact that I have, you know, my own accent or whatever, and I find other accents fucking fascinating. But to listen to a young you telling everyone that the Earth is 6,000 years old. Somehow your ignorance was adorable. And so I want to put that out there.
Well, yeah, I've never had any real talent with women, but whenever I've been to America, it's amazing because the girls are just like, oh my God, your accent is so cute. And then I'm straight in there. It's wicked.
Yeah, you have to come more often. See, what we really need is a cultural exchange, because I think if I go to England, everyone would be like, oh, your accent is so sexy. And I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? There's no accent here.
Right, exactly.
And it's the same vice versa. But, you know, it's not uncommon. Like, take for instance, the killer whale. Now, see, killer whales, when they try to determine who they should bang, they try to listen to the songs of other killer whales, and depending on how different the song is, they will either mate or not mate. So if the song is too similar, they won't mate. But
that's
if
true.
The song is different enough, then they will. So I think it's kind of the same way, right? Our speech is nothing but a glorified song.
I guess. And like with humans, if you go and see a band that's shit, then you don't want to have sex with the singer. But if you go and see a band and they're fucking amazing, you want to bang the singer.
Right. So, well, that's a different phenomenon altogether, though. That's part of that whole, you know, if you're kind of a songbird, very specifically, if you're doing anything also that requires quite a bit of talent, it's, everybody will just want to have sex with you. Doesn't matter if it's a girl or a guy. Well, depending on sexual preferences, of course. But nevertheless, we all have kind of an attraction to people who have, like, you know, are gifted at the art of song. I think that must be sort of a genetic thing. I mean, who hasn't at least had some crush on someone who sang something in the history of mankind? Come on now. Let's admit it. I mean, that must be one of the reasons why you do music. Be honest.
Yep. Didn't work either.
Well, you're still a young man. You're just, you know, you expect it to work right away? Now, come on now. It's like a fine wine. I mean, you have to develop yourself, and I think that we all agree you have to go somewhere where you're a little bit exotic, and then all of a sudden that's the right combination of things. So I just think that you have to go outside the little pond that you've been stuck in.
All right. Is that an invitation?
Well, you know, I don't have a lot of money, but, you know, if you want to come over to Montreal, which is where I'm moving in about like 4 days, and you want to come for a little while and impress the ladies here, and trust me, in Montreal, there is a proportion of hot ladies that would blow your fucking mind. I don't even think you're ready for the level of hotness. I mean, like, you know when you watch one of those movies from Hollywood and everyone's attractive and you're just like, that's not real life. It is where I come from, sir. And you, with your fucking accent, would do so good here. So the invitation's on you. Find a cheap way, I don't know, like stow away in a fucking ship, a cargo ship or something, or a plane or something like that. But you are definitely invited because, you know, as far as I'm concerned, anyone who has picked up that sort of like call to arms, when I put out there, I need the next generation of good atheists, you're one of the first guys. Not only did you respond, but you were just kind of like, you know, banging at my door, basically saying, hey, man, I got something to say. You got a big platform, and I want to say it. And let me tell you, that's the first rule of anybody that's the next generation of good atheists. The number one thing is you have to be enthusiastic enough to fucking track me down and to force me to come on the show. Because as far as I'm concerned, I'm not going to chase anybody. This is not my job. If you don't care enough about some issue that guy like me has to come over and be like, oh, are you ready to do a show? Do you have any topics picked out? No. Fuck that shit. I don't want to babysit anybody. I want people who are passionate, who have something to say, and who want to really kind of fundamentally change things in their own way. Now, you in particular have one locus of interest, which is essentially kind of fundamentalism, which is interesting because in your country, which as far as I think everybody that's in North America is concerned, we always think that England, it's such a secular place, right? I mean,
yeah.
Survey after survey shows that, conservatively speaking, 35% of almost half of your population is either, you know, atheist, non-religious, or no denomination. And yet, you are a Christian country.
Yeah. Well, I think that it's kind of like a vaccination effect, right? So America, like the United States, has no state religion. And so they just have crazy religious people, whereas we have like a weak form of the virus in the Church of England, and that means we're all immune to the crazy forms.
Well, the unfortunate thing, though, is that, like a virus, it's managed to kind of piggyback on some of the systems that already exist. And in your case, it is the educational system, which they've managed to sort of, like, grab on, like the fucking AIDS virus, like it will not go away. And it continues to get worse and worse and worse. It's not like it's improving. I mean, faith schools continue to expand. And, you know, like, as we're going to be covering a little bit later, as, you know, some of the materials that people are exposed to, it is shocking. It's the kind of thing that you would think is only in, like, Kansas or Louisiana. But no, take a fucking advanced, modern, even as what, like I said before, as far as everyone else is concerned, secular country. And even those places are really susceptible to the influence of religion. Now, before we start this, the other thing that I wanted to sort of like talk about is I received a letter from another listener of the show who has his own website. His name is Gamma Atheist, you know, like kind of like gamma rays, like a Hulk or something like that.
Got you.
And he sent me an email, and I'll read it to you. He says, "Dear Jake, I was referred to your site by a good friend of mine, AJ Johnson. Recently, my blog, GammaAtheist.com, has become an affiliate of Be Secular and other groups. My question really is, how can I continue to grow into a more activist role? I'm continually striving to better myself and other active atheists around me. I'm 26 years old, but unfortunately I do not have any degree that can help credit myself to be taken seriously on that level. I'm just a construction worker in the Bible Belt with a family of two kids. The blog has been picking up steam, I must say. So what do you think? Can I get my face out there more? How can I continue to expand my knowledge and abilities to show the world what I'm capable of? Thanks for reading, David." Okay, well, I wanted to answer this specifically for two reasons. Number one, when I started The Good Atheist, I was 26 years old. I was, you know, in a shit job. Like, I was just a fucking warehouse manager. And in a sense, I can sense where David is coming from, right? He's just at the cusp, really, of his activism. And the weird thing is, and I think that most people out there who have always thought about taking an activist role feel, is that they're like, well, everyone in the scene is so fucking smart. They have all these degrees and shit, and I'm a nobody. What can I do? Now, I think it's important for people to realize, number one, a degree, as far as the scene is concerned, sure, a degree may seem impressive, but people really care more about what you have to say rather than some fucking degree out there. Like, that's
and
the
it,
first thing.
In a lot of ways, it kind of makes him more relatable, because most people that are going to be listening are going to not have degrees as well.
No, exactly. And the thing is, The Good Atheist, as far as I'm concerned, was always one of those, look, you know, I'm all about trying to appeal to the, you know, sort of like the average atheist that's out there. I think that most people who listen to the show, you know, these are individuals that make up the largest section of atheists. These are just regular folks, right? These are just sort of like 9-to-5ers. They have jobs similar to working in construction, or they're just, it doesn't matter, because as far as I'm concerned, atheism is not an elitist movement. It doesn't require you to have a fucking college degree for you to just say that, hey, this religious shit is crap, and I don't believe it for one second.
I think the thing that's most interesting to me is that he's saying that he's like an atheist guy with two kids living in the Bible Belt. That's an interesting story right there that no one else is telling. What's that like? It must feel like everyone around you is kind of religious, or, you know, just surrounded by this incredibly religious culture, and you feel like this kind of oppressed minority, or I'm guessing, but this kind of story, I haven't read any other blogs that are like that. There's a whole kind of story. That's what people need to realize, is that if you're looking for your unique selling point, it's that you're you, and you're not Sam Harris, but we already have Sam Harris.
Right, we got cool. Richard Dawkins, we got Daniel Dennis. I mean, the intellectual crowd is already there, you know, and in a sense, I think that, and this is the reason why part of what I'm hoping to do with the new generation of good atheists is saying, well, you know, I have this platform, and for the most part, the people that listen are the very same people as David. They're just, you know, they were frustrated individuals living, many of them in the Bible Belt or in religious areas, that found something in my voice that they could relate to. And I think that ultimately, you know, the what we need is more people to relate to. We don't need better arguments, because the arguments are already there. They're not going to go away. I mean, think about everything that has already been produced, you know, in terms of podcasts, in terms of books, in terms of blog posts, which are all out there. I mean, you can go and you can just read all the arguments. You can watch countless videos of Christopher Hitchens nailing everybody to the fucking wall, and you're already aware of all the arguments. I think that most of us are, and we kind of grew up on that in the scene. We've been spending like, you know, 6 or 7 years feeding off that shit. But now what we need is we need a way for all of us to relate to one another in some form. And yep. This is where kind of guys like Gamma Atheists or like you, you know, this is where you guys come in. I've always believed, and I said this on one of my show, that for the most part, I think atheism is a movement of young people. This is why even at 33, I feel like a fucking dinosaur. And it's not because I'm old. I mean, I will eventually get there. But it's because it's not even my generation of people that are going to make the biggest impact on this whole atheism thing. Because if you look at the numbers, if you look at who's right now from 18 to 26 years old, this is the greatest proportion of non-believers that we've probably ever seen in the history of fucking mankind. But the problem is that, you know, sort of they grew up on kind of grandpappy's atheism, and now they need to define it for themselves. They need to find their voice, and that's going to take a lot of different forms. That's what I'm excited about. I mean, like, trying to find people that are just talented, have opinions, and most importantly, can connect with the fucking average person, because that's who we need to appeal to now. I mean, all the fucking scientists, the philosophers, the mathematicians, anybody who's really educated, yeah, they're already atheists. We don't need to convert these motherfuckers, okay? They're done. Now the remainder, the largest section of believers, are individuals who are just like us, who are just probably so close to abandoning this religious bullshit. But they need something that's a little bit more than just an intellectual argument. You know, they need to relate to people. So, you know, in a sense, when David was asking me, what is my activism? That's a complicated question because, in a sense, your activism has everything to do with you, right? You are your own kind of, you know, you're like a unique blend. You're like a spicy little dish. And as unique as you are, there are probably tons of people that are very similar and need to hear your brand of atheism. So with that in mind, now we're going to be introduced to your brand, Johnny, of activism. And you focus on one main element. So tell us a little bit more about this element in detail.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking that I think something else is that if you try and appeal to everybody, you end up appealing to nobody. Like, the stuff that appeals to everybody or that tries to appeal to everybody is like Creed and Jersey Shore. You don't want to do that. So
don't be the Jersey Shore of atheism, everybody.
You heard
it here first.
Yeah, I think the reason that I've had some success with what I'm doing is that I talk about one thing and people that are interested in that one thing care about what I do, and people that aren't interested read something else. So I went to a fundamentalist Christian school in the UK, and they used the accelerated Christian education curriculum.
Why did they call it accelerated, by the way? What does that even mean?
Well, the idea is that you can work through it at your own speed. So there are no teachers. You just have these workbooks. And so if you want to go through it at a million miles an hour and get all your studying done early, then in theory you can. And there are problems with that, but that's why it's called accelerated. And people on my blog have fun coming up with other things that it might stand for. So we should have a competition on the blog.
Right. Accelerated stupidity.
Right. Yes, how fast can you get dumb?
Now, you went to the school because, are your parents really religious, or what's the deal? Why did you go to this school?
Yeah, my parents were absolutely, well, now what you'd call fundamentalist Christians. We didn't really have that word around in the UK back then. And they were worried that I was going to get bullied if I went to secondary school. That's one of the big things that a lot of parents that send their kids to these schools are like, oh no, my kids, they're such evangelists, they're so on fire for Jesus that if they go to normal school they're going to get picked on and bullied. And there's this whole lie really that comes from the religious right, which is that they make it out that secular schools are much worse than they really are. They make out that they're just full of bullies and drug use and violence and just like wild sex. So
sounds like fun. Yeah,
exactly. It sounds amazing. Right, so So like, there's this whole, like, fear narrative, and so parents are like, I can't send my kid to that school, they've got to go to a Christian school. And when I actually finally escaped from my Christian concentration camp and went into, sorry, I shouldn't say concentration camp, because that's disrespectful to people that actually went through serious shit. But when I escaped from my
hellhole,
yeah, of a fundamentalist school, and I got to a normal school, and I was like, but none of you guys are having sex. It was disappointing, to be honest. I was like,
by the time you went there, I was expecting a certain amount of sort of like pussitude, and really all I got was sort of the same experience everyone had, where everyone's really uncomfortable, no one dances with girls at the school dance, and it's really all lame.
Yeah, whereas I thought it was just going to be like one epic orgy.
Damn, like ancient Rome, yeah.
Yeah.
Tisk, tisk. But I'm curious, how, like, what's the process of you actually having escaped there? So you go, you're in religious school. Do your parents change their fundamentalism? Did you change your fundamentalism? I mean, ultimately speaking, how could you have made this transition?
Yeah, well, it was difficult, but I didn't actually leave my fundamentalism when I left the school. I stayed a fundamentalist for at least another 5 years, but I was just so unhappy in this religious school. I got there and it was like the best experience of my life. I was like, this is where Jesus wants me to be. And I was so happy, and I thought I could feel the presence of God in the classroom. And it was just so exciting to be exactly where I felt God wanted me to be. And then just over time, I just got worn down by the constant rules, all these thousands and thousands of rules that fundamentalists have, and the way that we had to do all our work in silence in these little sectioned off desks where you couldn't see your neighbor on either side, so, and you definitely couldn't talk to anybody, so it's just like there in kind of solitary confinement doing this boring work over and over, and really having no friends because the schools were so tiny and the kind of religion was so divisive that I couldn't just be friends with normal people. I couldn't do things that normal people did. I didn't listen to secular music. I didn't watch most kind of secular TV programs. It was just slowly making my world smaller and smaller until I felt like I didn't have a friend in the world, and I was so depressed. And one day I just had a meltdown at school, and I freaked out, and I started shouting at everybody. And when my parents found out that happened, they were like, I think we need to get you out of here. So they did. And then I went to a normal school, and of course that was hell, because I was there like, well, you're all going to hell. And so of course.
Oh, so you were the judgmental little prick at school.
Right. I was that guy. And unsurprisingly, it took me a long time to make friends, because I was just the one that was like, yeah, I'm not having any sex before I get married. So then just everything was horrible, because I in the common room at school, all the guys had posters from FHM magazine and stuff, all these women around on the walls, and I didn't know where to look, because I was like, man, I will commit lust in my heart, which is the same as adultery according to the Bible, if I look at any of these pictures. So I just had to stare at the floor the whole time, and they'd be like, so that girl on that poster there, she's hot, right? And I'd be like, yeah. They're like, would you fuck her? And I'd be like, no, because I'm not having sex until I get married. And then I get bullied.
So in a weird sense, it's almost like you're creating a self-fulfilling prophecy about the bullying that happens in sort of these schools, right?
Yeah, if I could go back in time, I'd bully myself, because I was an obnoxious little fundamentalist judgmental oik.
But that's not how you felt. At the time, you felt kind of like the hero's journey, right? Sort of like you're in this secular hellhole.
Absolutely. I was God's representative there, and, you know, it was my responsibility to help these people come to see Jesus and avoid damnation.
Was there anybody else that was almost as fundamental as you, or were you just sort of like the one guy in the crowd?
At that school, that was shitty. There was this one other girl that was evangelical. I didn't have much to do with her.
See, that seems weird. You would think that the two evangelicals would somehow, you know.
Yeah, well, this is the problem with fundamentalism. This is why it's the worst thing in the world for a child, because she wasn't exactly the same kind of fundamentalist I was. Like, right? Every fundamentalist believes that they interpret the Bible completely literally and they believe all of it completely. and yet they meet someone else that claims exactly the same thing, and yet they have totally different beliefs, or not even totally different beliefs, slightly different beliefs. And that should, right there, just be like, well, fundamentalism is obviously not true. If you're both reading the same book, literally, and coming to different conclusions, this book is not a useful way of figuring out what you should believe. But we didn't think that. We just thought the other person was an idiot. So this girl wasn't fundamentalist enough for me, even though by most people's standards she was totally fundamentalist. So I was like, well, you know, you're not the right kind of Christian, so I'm not hanging out with you.
So you were the most fundamentalist guy in your school then?
I was the most fundamentalist guy in the world.
How did you get this sort of like that hardcore? I mean, are your parents that hardcore, or did you take it to the next level?
I took it to the next level. I really got radicalized. I kind of took on board everything. I didn't take anything with a grain of salt. So there was all of what my parents believed, and then I was watching the televangelists on the God Channel, as we have over here, which is like our equivalent of TBN or whatever,
right?
And taking on board what they were saying. And then there was the stuff in my fundamentalist school books when I was at that school that was telling me that, you know, it was against God's will for governments to provide health care for citizens. And I was going, yep, right on with that too. And then there was this guy at my church who had been to a Bible college in Tulsa, and he was so extreme in his views, and I just really looked up to him. Like, teenagers pick somebody to have as a hero, and he was my hero. So everything he said, I just took and was like, yeah, totally, I'm on board with all of that. So I ended up being so, so radical. And I remember a few months after 9/11, I was listening to A Thought for the Day, which is on BBC Radio in this country. They have a spiritual slot in the radio in the morning where a religious speaker will come on and say something. And this religious speaker was on there, and he said, I think fundamentalism of all kinds is harmful, whether you're a Muslim fundamentalist or a Christian fundamentalist. And I remember thinking, no, 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 you're doing this all wrong. Fundamentalism is the only way to go. And I have more respect for the Muslim fundamentalist than I have for you, because you're a woolly compromiser. And at least those Muslim fundamentalists believe what they, you know, they say what they mean and they do what they say they're going to do. So I, as far as I was concerned, it was more respectable to be Osama bin Laden than it was to be a vicar in an English Church of England church. And then a few years later, I thought about myself and I was like, man,
that's fucked up.
I would have been a terrorist if I'd been in a different culture. You know, I was lucky that the one thing I can say for the type of fundamentalism I was in is that it wasn't violent. And if it had been, I would have been queuing up to kill myself because I was that extreme.
So the brand of fundamentalism you had was more, what, like isolationist, I guess, is
but yeah,
like, how did it manifest itself? Like,
well, I was in the charismatic end of fundamentalism. Now, what fundamentalism gets complicated here, because there are Christians that would actually call themselves fundamentalists, and those guys tend to be independent fundamental Baptists, and they don't wear jeans, and they all have conservative hairstyles, and the women don't really expose any flesh because it's very important they dress modestly, and they don't have any kind of rock music, even Christian rock music, because they think that's all just inherently demonic, and they live this very, very pure lifestyle. And I wasn't one of those, but I would still say that I was a fundamentalist because I really thought that the whole Bible had to be taken literally. So that's kind of what I mean when I say fundamentalist.
And familiar were you with the Bible by then? Like, you know, were you, did you read it many times over and stuff like that? Or were you only mildly aware of it?
No, I was more than most Christians. I read the Bible a lot, but I tended to read the same old passages. I knew people that did read the Bible. I knew one family that made a point of reading through the Bible every year. And now I think back on that, and I'm like, you read the Bible every year, and you didn't notice the problems with this? Like, but no, I wasn't someone that read. There are parts of the Old Testament that I probably never read, or, you know, read maybe only once. But I was part of this whole charismatic thing where I was praying in tongues all the time, and the worship was really ecstatic, and there was lots of shaking and laughing and weird physical manifestations. That was the type of fundamentalism I was in.
So give me a timeline here. So you go to secular school, you're still a fundamentalist. What broke it down? What was like that first what the fuck am I doing moment?
Well, I can't break it down to one what the fuck am I doing moment, but there were a couple of pivotal moments when I was at school. One was when we studied evolution and biology at GCSE. And I was a total creationist. And as soon as they said we were going to do evolution, I was like, right, I'm going to have an argument here. I'm not going to take this. And when the teacher actually explained natural selection the way that she did, I was like, oh, well, that's quite
Logical.
And that's not what I was told it was by my fundamentalist teachers. So I still didn't accept it, but I was like, oh, that's actually kind of plausible. And what my fundamentalist teachers told me evolution was actually not true. So that kind of was just something that I kind of went away in the back of my mind. And then later in history class, my history teacher told me what communism was. And again, I'd been told that communism was the most evil thing. You know, it was sent by the devil to destroy Christianity, and it was just the worst thing ever. And when the teacher explained that actually it was sharing, it was essentially, you know, whatever your political views are, and you can say, well, communism doesn't work and in practice, and it was all kinds of flawed and stuff. But the ideal of let's have a really sharing society, that's not a really evil thought. That's quite a nice thought. And so, again, I was like, wait, so what my fundamentalist teachers told me was not true. So I had those things, and those things kind of built up over time. And then eventually, when I was kind of equivalent of last kind of year of high school in America, I started to read. And you should never read if you're a fundamentalist. That's a dangerous thing to do.
Well, never read anything other than the Bible or books about the Bible.
Right. By people that believe the Bible is perfect.
the unerrant word of God. And, you exactly. know, speaking as someone who's rewriting the Old Testament, I have to tell you, it's always the subtle things that I find that I love. Like, for instance, I'm rewriting Nehemiah, whatever his name is.
Nehemiah.
And there's a section near the end, actually, where he talks about they're rereading the laws of Moses, and they discover a new passage that says, oh, well, anyone who's an Ammonite and a Moabite are not allowed in the procession of God. And he discovers that a few of the Jews have had wives from, you know, sort of foreigners, and he goes and he beats the shit out of all these kids. He just beats the shit out of them. He beats them, tears their hair apart, and says, you're not allowed to marry any foreign women. And when you read that, I mean, like, from a modern perspective, you're just like, why did you literally tear out their head, the hair on their heads for just being born whatever way they were being born? You're a big dick. You're a piece of shit.
It's not wonderful.
No, there's not a lot of love in there.
It's probably not what a perfect, loving God would write if he could write just one book.
Now, so, well, see, the whole loving God thing, I think that's really a tool of the modern world. Because if you look at the way that most people felt about God, I mean, God-fearing used to be a compliment. If you were afraid of your deity, you were doing all right by him. So you're just like, you know what? The people that I love, I don't fear. I that's not an emotion that comes to mind when I think about the ones that I love, generally speaking.
No, and like Christopher Hitchens said, if you've got to love someone that you're afraid of, that's sadomasochism.
Yeah, that's a bit scary. Now, there will be some people who like that shit, but for the most part, unless they're, you know, severely damaged, we kind of like to separate this whole fear and love thing. Generally, they're just, you know, as far as we're concerned, not too compatible.
I certainly want to kind of keep it to role play.
Right. Keep it in the bedroom if you're going to beat the shit out of each other.
I suppose it's what religion is for a lot of Christians, isn't it? It's role play. It's what they do on Sunday.
Well, you know, it is a role in the sense that I've always believed this, that most people who are religious, every single human being has a very unique religion that is just all about themselves. I mean, if you're a fundamentalist, in your own mind, it's no coincidence that God believes everything that you do. But in a way, that's ludicrous. I mean, even if there was a God, why would he believe everything that you do? I mean, there's definitely going to be room for some mistakes. But you ask a fundamentalist, he's like, oh, I know exactly what God wants. Is that so?
Yeah, well, these schools that I'm talking about, their selling point is that they teach children to see life from God's point of view. I'm like, well, that's impressive, because you obviously know God's point of view so that you can teach it to children.
Right, and everybody's got a different point of view, so what's up with that? So tell me a little bit about this accelerated Christian education. Now, there are a few of these schools in the UK, but there's a lot more in the US. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think there are about 5,000 in the US. From the best, there aren't good numbers available, so you're always dealing with kind of estimates and stuff. The numbers for the UK that we have are quite accurate, actually, because the Christian Education Europe, who bring it to the UK made a statement to Parliament in 2009 where they said that there were 59 schools in the UK using this curriculum. So it's probably 59 schools, or less, however many have closed or opened since then. In the US, it took about 5,000. There are a lot in Canada. There are something in the region of 200 in like Australia and the South Pacific. There are a lot in Africa. They claim it's in 192 countries.
That's a lot of countries.
The guy who founded it, who isn't with them anymore and actually died recently, but he put a lot of effort into spreading it around the world. He managed to cut deals with governments in like Guatemala and Russia to have actually it appearing even in government schools out there. It's quite scary what they managed to achieve.
And so give me an idea of – so you said that the numbers are difficult to track, at least in the U.S. And I think that, you know, I don't know if you saw this a couple of days ago. There was this science test that was on Reddit, and it kind of like became
– I know the one, yep.
Yeah, it became extremely popular. And at first, everyone was trying to track down, is this real? Is this fake? And the scary thing is that once sort of people started investigating, not only did they discover that this is real, but I think that people underestimated how many schools have some similarly ridiculous kind of like non-science tests. And that I think that the one thing about that Reddit post was that the parent who had sent his kid to that school had no idea, even though it was a religious school, that this was the kind of test that they were going to have, because I think that maybe they thought, well, this is a private school, and, you know, sort of like they must have some kind of rules in terms of their, you know, what their curriculum is or whatever. And I think that a lot of people would be surprised by saying, no, generally speaking, if you're a private school in the U.S., you can teach whatever the fuck you want, regardless of how garbage it is.
There were lawsuits in Kentucky about schools like the ones that I'm talking about, where they tried to insist that the schools had to have state accreditation and they had to use state accredited staff. And the Kentucky Supreme Court said, no, it's fine. The schools can do what they want if they're private. And then the U.S. Supreme Court actually refused to look at the case. They didn't give any comments. So, you know, certainly in Kentucky, you can teach whatever the hell you want if you're a private school. And that would be a similar situation in many U.S. states. And it's what you say about parents not fully realizing, I think, is really important. Like, my parents were conservative evangelicals for sure, but they I don't think really realized how extreme the school that the curriculum that they were signing me up for was. And because I worked on my own and in silence at this work, you know, there was no real involvement on their part in what I was doing. I was just getting on with it and getting more and more extreme in my views, and they were only partly aware.
But how do fundamentalist parents who, let's say, I don't know, let's create a scale for, you know, just the sake of measurement. Let's say that, you know, your parents were an 8 on this scale and you're, you know, sort of like a 9 moving towards a 10 during this sort of like, you know, accelerated Christian education. How does a fundamentalist parent who's an 8 feel about their children if they're even more fundamentalist than they are?
Well, I think that the way that the parents think is that all that really matters is that my child knows Jesus and is going to heaven. That's all that really matters. And because they believe that Jesus is coming back soon, and that even if he doesn't, what really matters is eternity and heaven. That matters far more than just the handful of years that we're on this planet for. So if the education's not that great, and they believe some political views that aren't that savory, and they don't have such a good opportunity to go to university because they haven't had such a good education, that stuff doesn't matter as much as if they know Jesus. So as long as a child is happy about Jesus, then everyone's winning as far as they're concerned.
So the details of that doesn't really matter to them?
I think not.
Well, what about your parents now? I mean, are they still fundamentalists?
Well, my dad's dead, so I'd say it's very unlikely that he believes in God anymore.
Well, what about your mom?
My mum has kind of come round to my way of seeing things after many years, and it's been really painful for both of us to realize that we wasted so many years of our lives. You know, that's the real difficult thing. It's especially difficult for her. You know, she lives with the kind of guilt of, you know, I put my children through this. But she's more than made up for it in the years since. You know, she's pretty awesome.
Was your father really the one who carried the fundamentalist torch? Is that one of the reasons why sort of it was easier to transition to atheism?
Yeah, I can't imagine what would happen if he'd still been alive, because I can't imagine him ever changing his mind about anything. So I guess I would just have no relationship with him, because, yeah, it's hard to imagine.
So I guess, in effect, I mean, I've had people on the show before who've talked about alienation from their family members because of their beliefs, and how, in a sense, not that I want to trivialize, of course, the trauma of that death, but that it can be worse. That, you know, when a family member or loved one is still alive and refuses to have a relationship with you because of the differences in these beliefs. Like, you know, they might be even your next door neighbor, and yet they don't even want to talk to you because they, you know, they feel that you've strayed from the path or that you're going to hell. And you know, the one thing that fundamentalists are always, you know, always make sure that they remind you of is where you're going to fucking go when you die.
Yeah. Oh, God, it's just unimaginable if it had been like with that with my dad, but. Fuck. Yeah, but I mean, I was on the road to having no relationship with him anyway, because he used to use Christianity as an excuse for being a bit of a rubbish dad. So, you know, if I came to him with a problem, he'd be like, well, you know, have you prayed about it? And if I was like, you know, whichever answer I get, he's like, well, you know, you're not, if you're still whining about this, then you're obviously not trusting God. You know, if you prayed, then God answers prayer, that's it, shut up about it now. So you know, it wasn't like we had a good relationship.
Well, okay, so let's talk about this accelerated Christian learning. I want you to give me some ideas about the kinds of things that you were learning. So, you know, like we said before, I mean, a lot of parents who send their kids to these fucking schools have absolutely no idea the kind of education. So the first thing you mentioned is that everything is done in some kind of weird, creepy silence. Can you explain to me what the idea behind this is exactly? Like, why is there no participation? Why are you sitting yourself by yourself studying this shit alone? What's the idea?
Well, the idea is that what they say is the idea is that every student can work at their own speed. So that means that they can, you know, nobody gets held up and the stupid kids at the back aren't feeling like they're under pressure to work faster. That's the reason they're saying it. But I think what's really happening is that by having no group involvement, there's no opportunity for dissent because you never get a chance to discuss anything. There's no possibility of the kids kind of expressing doubts to each other during that kind of learning time and possibly going off on what they would say is the wrong track. And what really matters is that, you know, ACE has all the answers. So there's no need for there to be any discussion. There's no need for there to be any kind of group interaction, because all the wisdom has been written down in these books. And you've just got to memorize the wisdom that's come from God. And then you know everything that you need to know. And that's it. Job done. And they say that, you know, the kind of thing that you get from group interaction and those kinds of things is ideas. And they don't want you to have ideas. They want you to have facts, as they say them.
But like you said before, it seems to kind of create this tremendous isolation. I mean, is this the experience that other people in fundamentalist schools have, like, often, where they're just, you don't make any friends, you're just kind of like, you know, isolated? It seems very strange. I mean, a school setting seems like the kind of place where people are supposed to interact with others their age and, you know, kind of make friends, have fun to some degree.
Yeah, well, if there's anyone that's an advocate of ACE listening to this, they're going to say that I'm misrepresenting it, because in most schools you spend half the day in the situation that I've described, and then in the afternoon you would do other things. And there are break times and there are lunch times where the kids can socialize. So they're like, hey, the kids get loads of social interaction and stuff. And that's true, but you only get social interaction with other fundamentalists. And what I found was that I was kind of okay, not great, but okay at socializing with other fundamentalists, but I was absolutely terrible at socializing with anyone else my age from any other kind of culture, any secular kid, any kid from another religion. I could not speak to them. I was terrified of them because there was all this propaganda about how they were full of sin and evil and going to lead me astray. And I had nothing in common with them because my life was so weird and different from theirs that when they used slang in conversation, I didn't even know what some of the words meant because I'd never heard them before.
So, I mean, how much do you think that stunted your social growth? I mean,
I used to reckon I was about 7 years behind. I remember when I was 21, I kind of wrote in my diary that I'd just begun to swim from the surface, like as if I'd been living on the ocean floor all my life, and I was just finally going to swim to the surface. And I felt like I broke air when I was about 22, and I started to get back on track and become normal. And it was something I actually consciously worked on. I used to make myself go out and socialize with people and talk to people because it was something that I knew that I hadn't been able to do.
Well, I've always felt that to some degree, I mean, like human experiences, although they do differ, I mean, we all go through particular stages. I remember for me, like, you know, when I was trying to look back and say, well, what makes me the individual that I am? And there were certain situations where I had advanced at a regular rate. Like, for instance, I did go to a, you know, normal school, made normal friends and so on and so forth. But there was a part of my life, like, for instance, I was from 18 years old to like 26. I did not have any girlfriends, you know, like not even a kiss and that kind of stuff. Like yeah. Just completely, like at least that was one part of my life that was really retarded. And that when I looked at the kinds of relationship experiences that I had gone through in my later years, I realized that those relationships were actually reflected the kinds of relationships that one experiences. And when you're much younger, because, you know, we all have to go through the same process. It's just that some of us go through different stages. You know, like the same way that we talk, you know, when people try to understand why is it that the celibate priests of Catholic churches are child pedophiles? And my answer to this is that, well, you know, when we're all children, we all have a kind of sexuality about us. It may not be expressed the same way that adults are, but, you know, it sort of like reaches its maturity, it moves on, and eventually you become attracted to people who are, you know, again, going through the same stages. But if you never go through those stages, you'll always be stuck in one particular place. And I think that in the instance of pedophiles, this is where, you know, a person is trapped, if you want, in a particular stage of their development, and they stay there. They never evolve beyond it because they were never able to have the kinds of experiences that they should have had. Specifically because, at least in the case of, say, Catholic Church or many other fundamentalist religions, they're not allowed to. And so, you know, in your case, for instance, you said you were 7 years behind and you had to play catch-up. Did you find that that was kind of true, that a lot of times that people just sort of, like, noticed there was a certain immaturity about certain things and that, you know, you felt embarrassed about that?
Yeah, well, I just felt like all the opportunities that I should have had, like you're saying, were kind of teenage first awkwardness and, you know, first drink and first time socializing with girls and stuff. I was just doing 7 years later and fucking it up. And I was like, but it's worse because I'm 21 and I've met this girl and she likes me and I like her and she doesn't know why I'm being so weird. I remember vividly meeting this girl and really hitting it off. And then we agreed that we'd meet at a gig later that week. And I got to the venue and realized that she was there and went and hid in the toilet. I was 20. Yeah, you know, yeah, it's just, yeah. I'm just like, fuck.
Well, we all have to go through those kind of particular stages of why is it that someone of the, you know, like that I'm attracted to is scaring the shit out of me? I don't get it.
Yeah. And I was especially extra scared because I'd always been taught that you shouldn't date anyone unless you're going to marry them. That was the rule at the fundamentalist school, and there were rules that, like, boys and girls weren't allowed to come within 6 inches of each other to, you know, preserve our purity. So anytime I thought about going on a date with a girl, I got shit scared because I was convinced that I was going to have to marry her. I was like, if I go and have coffee with this girl, then the next thing is I've got to apply for a wedding license. And that's a lot of pressure.
And I'm sure the kinds of girls that were interested in you would just love that kind of conversation. Be like, yeah, well, let's go out for coffee, and then we're going to go get a marriage certificate.
Yeah, right. Just crazy. And the other thing I thought was that I thought that women didn't like sex because that was the vibe that you got from fundamentalist schools. So whenever I was interested in a girl, I was determined to, like, show how I wasn't like all those other bad, horrible men that wanted to have sex with them. I was one of the good guys, and I didn't want to have sex with them. And then I was surprised when they left with the guy that did want to have sex with them. I was like, what am I doing wrong?
But I was such a nice guy.
Yeah. I'm such a nice guy, yeah.
It's not so much the girls don't like the nice guys, is that eventually you have to, you know, whip it out.
There has to be some attraction.
So okay, let's go back to your accelerated Christian quote unquote education.
Yeah.
And there's a section that you wanted to talk about, which was one of the history lessons that you're being taught. So give us an impression of this course.
Okay. Well, the history course is called World History. And it is 12 booklets long, and the booklets are on average about 40 pages, including, that's all the text for all the information about the history of the world.
All world history.
Whole of world history in, well, so what, 12 times 40, so 480 pages. Whole of world history, everything you need to know. And that includes all the questions and the activities that you have to do. So that's not just the information, that's everything. 480 pages. So obviously, this is not going to be in that much depth. Now, the other thing is that it starts, of course, with the creation of the world in six literal days, and then Adam and Eve, and then it goes to Noah, and then it goes to, like, Abraham, or there's Moses and stuff in between, isn't there? But, wait. Abraham is Abraham then Moses, isn't it?
Abraham Man, then Moses, yeah.
Abraham then, you know this better than I do, see, I've done my best to forget it. So anyway.
Well, that's okay. By the time my book comes out, you'll be re-familiarized with it.
Awesome. Awesome. Buy Jake's book, everybody. Right. So the history course, everything is just facts. Like, this is the fact that happened. Memorize this fact by filling in the blank, and then it's done. And that's just, I mean, a terrible way to teach history. Even if everything in these books was totally accurate and there was none of the creationist stuff, that would be a terrible way to teach history, because history is all about perspectives, and we don't know for sure what happened, but we have varying amounts of evidence, and we look at the evidence and try and work out what happened. And that's a fascinating process. So just to say, you know, in 2540 BC, this happened on this date, that's boring. And history is this fascinating thing that they've managed to turn into this dead, lifeless subject. But they've made it interesting for me by the fact that they cannot tell fact from fiction, which is amazing. I mean, they start, obviously, with the Genesis story, which they think is fact. It's like, there's a talking snake in here. This is a pretty strong indicator that somebody was writing an allegory, because that's how stuff works. But when we get onto the Greeks, then they start talking about the Trojan horse and about Ajax and Agamemnon and Achilles. And these guys are all mythical characters.
Right,
it's like,
right.
Do you guys know what a myth is? Because not only have you failed to understand the myths of your own culture, but you've then encountered the myths of another culture, and you've gone, well, this must all be, like, historical fact, too.
It's interesting that they actually went to the sort of, like, the Greek story of Troy. It seems like, you know, at least in terms of the dates that we think we know, these are all really just kind of guesses. I mean, we think that maybe a guy called Achilles existed. But, you know, as far as what the dates are, I mean, we're talking about a pretty large margin of error here.
Yeah, well, I think we're pretty confident that Achilles is pure myth. I mean, we're talking about a guy that was allegedly, you know, dipped in the magic potion by the ankle.
I think it's dragon's blood, actually.
Is that what it is? Okay.
I think so. I'm not quite sure. I just know that his mother had to hold him by the heel when dipping him into it, which is why the heel was not invincible.
Exactly. So you've got all of this stuff, which is just clearly mythical, or at least, you know, and there may be elements of history intertwined with this, but we have a real hard time separating what's what, because what we have is the Iliad and the Odyssey, which clearly contain huge amounts of mythical stuff mixed in with anything that may be history. And they're just there going, teaching all this stuff like it's objective historical facts. It's like, you guys just don't know what history is. You don't know what the subject of history is. You don't know how it's studied.
But what about, like, because in the Iliad and the Odyssey, there are specific references to the way in which gods interfere with events. So do they just skip those parts because these are pagan gods or something? I'm a bit confused about where they start, you know, excising certain materials that might conflict with their own religion.
Well, exactly. And I'm confused too, because I'm looking at this and going, everything in here is taught as fact. There's no possibility that they're saying, okay, we're going to look at some myths here. That's not explicitly stated at any time. And indeed, they're talking about the Bible, and it's very clear that that's meant to be historical. And then, you know, in the next couple of books, we're going to be looking at, you know, World War One, and obviously they talk about that as historical. And yet here, they actually say these heroes were stronger and better than ordinary men. They had fellowship with the gods and did mighty deeds. So clearly that bit doesn't tie in with their religion. So they must be thinking that that is kind of mythical. But they don't say that.
It seems just so confused.
It's so confused. It's almost as though it's written by blithering idiots.
Almost? Jeez, almost. You would think maybe. Yeah,
yeah,
maybe that's a possibility. So what else? What was another kind of like topic? Because I've heard, and I think that some people probably think that this is untrue or some kind of crazy rumor, that there are some fundamentalist science books that try to prove that dinosaurs and men coexisted, and they use as an example the Loch Ness Monster. Is this an actual fact? Did you experience this?
Not only did I experience this, I'm the reason everybody's heard about this. This is my one big achievement in atheist activism, is bringing this to the public attention. And yeah, it's completely true. In one of their ninth grade science books, they're talking about how humans and dinosaurs lived at the same time because God made them all at once, and that maybe Noah took baby dinosaurs onto the ark, and that most of them would have died out because after the flood, the atmosphere on Earth completely changed, which made it harder for dinosaurs to live, but for some reason wasn't a problem for all the other animals. And so because of this, because dinosaurs were alive quite recently, and because we think that they were on Noah's Ark, it would kind of be not that surprising for the creationist, they say, if there were some dinosaurs alive today, whereas that would completely, they say, blow evolutionary theory out of the water, because evolutionists say that, you know, the dinosaurs were 65 million years ago, so even if they had survived, they would have evolved into something else by now, right? Because this is how little they understand evolutionary theory. So then they go on to say, have you heard of the Loch Ness Monster in Scotland? Nessie has been... Now, let me get the exact quote here, because this is genius. Nessie has been... Nessie, for short, has been recorded on sonar from a small submarine, described by eyewitnesses, and photographed by others. Nessie appears to be a plesiosaur. Nessie appears... to be a plesiosaur.
From the photographs that some people took.
Yeah, and I mean, what really is bad about this, apart from the obvious bullshit side of it, is that they're saying scientists are speculating about this, and then they're saying that the reason scientists believe that Nessie is alive is because of eyewitness testimony by people that claim to have seen it, and photographs. It's like, that's not how science proceeds. So as well as distorting the facts of the case about Nessie and the case about evolution, they're also distorting the way that scientists work, which really threatens, you know, the child's future chances of ever being able to work as a scientist.
So when you heard this, A, did you believe that Nessie existed? And B, was this a satisfactory answer to the question of dinosaurs?
You're damn right I believe that Nessie existed, and I remember being kind of excited by this possibility, and I tied in with things that I'd heard from other creationists, and I was just like, man, one day I'll go to Loch Ness and I'll pray, and maybe God will, you know, miraculously show me Nessie and I'll get to see it, and that would be so exciting. And I really thought that, and I remember even at church there was a girl that I went to church with that made fun of me for this, because even she wasn't that crazy, but I was totally down with it. I was like, what? No, you don't know anything. This is like, you know, this is creationism. This is what we believe. And yeah, so I remember when I went to my secular school having a conversation with someone being like, so, you know, do you think there's a dinosaur in Loch Ness? He was like, no. And I was like, yeah, but come on. He was like, no, it's not possible. And explained to me various reasons why there's not a dinosaur in Loch Ness. And in any case, right, plesiosaurs were not dinosaurs. So this is a biology text which is saying that plesiosaurs are dinosaurs. And that's the kind of thing that I want a biology book to get right.
Yeah, well, you know, that's usually the first thing. But so, I'm kind of curious, like, you know, even fundamentalists, you know how kids, you know, kids and dinosaurs, right? Like, what kid is not fascinated by gigantic fucking quote-unquote terrible lizards, even though they're not lizards? But, you know, like, just there's a universal appeal to dinosaurs here. So was this kind of like their weird way of trying to be like, oh yeah, not, you know, yeah, you can love dinosaurs, they were all around, they were like the Flintstones?
yeah, it's 80s idea of a documentary. The I guess so, yeah. I mean, it was exciting to me. Creationism was so exciting. This, I mean, for one thing, the thought that there was proof for what I believed, you know, I believed it anyway, but then I came along and I was like, what, you're telling me there's proof that this is definitely true? This is amazing. And then the thought of this early human history where dinosaurs and man were frolicking side by side was exciting to me. And then also there was this kind of, I guess, feeling of superiority because, you know, most of the world accepts the theory of evolution. And I felt like I knew something they didn't know because they were all these stupid idiots that believed this ridiculous theory of evolution that one day a monkey gave birth to a human, obviously stupid. And I knew the real truth. It was a feeling of power.
It kind of almost sounds like the way that a lot of conspiracy theorists feel, you know, like there's that someone has overlooked information that you know, sort of like you have access to it, and therefore, you know, that makes you special. And it sounds like that kind of like plays into this whole idea that yes, you're separate from everyone else, which is kind of like, you know, this is because you've separated yourself. But, you know, as far as the people who are in that situation are concerned, it's the rest of the world that's split off from what they think is really the truth.
Right. And creationism is a conspiracy theory. I mean, to believe in creationism, as I was taught it, you have to believe that all the scientists in the world know that evolution is a hoax, but that they are all engaged in pushing forward the theory of evolution, even though they know it's not true, because they don't want to believe in God, so they're suppressing the truth. That's what I was taught.
So they're just taught that scientists are kind of evil God oppressors, I guess?
Well, yeah, the ones that believe in evolution and that teach evolution, yeah, that's exactly what I thought about them. And I had something else to say, which I've forgotten.
But what was the reason why, like, how does a fundamentalist explain why a scientist would willfully participate in such fraud? I mean, they say just so they can deny God, but, like, is there a more satisfying explanation? Because, I mean, even that explanation might leave you with a lot of questions.
Right. Well, I remember thinking, I mean, I accepted that explanation, but I was like, but that's so weird, because you always tell me that the gospel's good news. And, you know, the gospel, as I was taught it, is just if you accept Jesus, then you will have an amazing life and then you'll live forever in this perfect place where you'll be completely happy. I was like, if that's true and the scientists all know it's true, why wouldn't they want to believe that? But they said that it was because they were rebellious because, you know, for them, Christianity is really about obedience and about submission, about submitting to God. So they were saying, you know, scientists were really proud. They don't want to have to be subject to something that's bigger than them. So they just, you know, sinful natures. That's why there was no more satisfying explanation than that. That was the explanation.
So in the theme of submission, how much really does it play out in any other kinds of ways in fundamentalist schools? I mean, like, you know, we talk about the way that religion tries to get people to essentially, you know, I mean, Islam, what does it mean? You know, sort of like submission. So there is a strong sense that one has to, you know, completely and utterly abandon something, that they need someone else to tell them what to do. Does this have any other sort of, does it play out in any sort of kind of ways in these schools? Like, do they expect every student to be submissive in all forms?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what the whole rote learning thing, I think, is really about, this whole system of education where you're not teaching children how to think, you're just teaching them what to think, because what they're learning is to submit to authority, and that their parents and teachers have been put over them by God, and they learn to submit to their teachers and parents first, and then when they're older, they'll be submitting directly to God. That's what it's about. And so at my school, you know, if you were any sign of rebellion, you could be spanked with a paddle. And that was ACE's manual gave 3 pages of instructions to teachers on the correct way to paddle children. They've taken it out now, obviously, because it was so controversial and was becoming illegal in so many of the places where they were trying to sell their stuff that it was just a liability for them. But for years and years, from when they first opened up until at least 1999, they had detailed instructions. So for 30 years, detailed instructions on how to beat kids the correct way to make sure they were obedient.
So let's go back to the curriculum here. And I want you to sort of like explain to me. So, they believe that the flood is a kind of literal thing. But this has specific consequences in terms of how they teach history. Is that right?
Right. So there's this guy in the British creation science movement who's written a book called After the Flood. Now, we don't have as many creationists in the UK, but we've made up for it by having ones that are even crazier than the ones that you have in the US. And the creation science movement has this book, After the Flood, and the subtitle is The Early Post-Flood History of Europe Traced Back to Noah. And what this guy claims in his book is that he has successfully managed to find genealogies from early histories of European peoples and other cultures that prove that we are all descended from Noah. He reckons that he's actually got the record, the list of names that goes right back to Noah, and that he can prove this from historical records. Now, in the US, the kids study a book called Did Man Just Happen? By W.A. Criswell, a famous creationist from Texas. But in the UK and Europe, instead of doing that, they do After the Flood, and they learn that we're all descended from Noah, and that we can prove this from the genealogical records. It's so far out crazy that most creationists would even be like, well, that's ridiculous, you can't say that, but they're down with it, they're just letting the crazy fly. And not only that, he also is full of the claims about dinosaurs. It's like Anglo-Saxon, any kind of folklore, myth, legend that there's ever been about dragons or monsters or dinosaurs, this guy just takes as objective proof that dinosaurs survived the floods and were with us today. So he comes out with stuff like saying, the author's name is Bill Cooper, and he says that there were dinosaurs living in Wales at the start of the 20th century. There were... What?
sorry, like what kind of dinosaurs exactly is he talking about?
Well, exactly, and he describes them. He's got some, quotation from Welsh legend, and which describes these shining, multicolored creatures that are kind of like snakes with wings. It's like... What?
And it's not just about dinosaurs, right? He's talking about the differences in, well, what some people call race, although there is no such fucking thing. I would say sort of like the difference in pigmentation and slight differences in morphology. But he claims in this book, if I'm not mistaken, that Noah's son, a cursed son, Ham, is really the descendant of all, black people. Is that correct?
Right. And there are some fundamentalists. I don't know that this author would go with that, but so there are certainly some fundamentalists that have used this belief to be like, yeah, black people are cursed, and they use that to justify slavery. I mean, this is the thing that fundamentalists claim that their beliefs have never changed. Fundamentalist beliefs have fucking changed, and that should give us hope for the future because it means that they can change again. But fundamentalists used to use the Bible to prove that the sun went round the earth and that the earth was flat. Both of those things people have used the Bible to try and prove. And now they've given up on both of those things because they realize they're so ridiculous that they can't try and claim them anymore. So then the next thing was slavery. They were like, no, the Bible, through the curse of Ham, shows that slavery is the right thing to do. And then when they lost the argument on slavery, it was segregation. And now it's gay marriage. And they'll lose the argument on that. In a few years, it'll be something else. So slowly, slowly, fundamentalism is not evolving as fast as we'd like and not as fast as the rest of society, but it is evolving.
I think it's also quite interesting that when you find out why is Ham cursed, and you realize it's one of those other kind of like shitty examples of how the Bible is just a completely unfair, crappy, description of people's behavior. So Ham essentially finds his father drunk and naked and sees him in this condition, and as a result is cursed. So What is his crime exactly of walking in on his drunk, naked dad? I mean, like, I think that we all agree that the one who's at fault here is Noah, not Ham.
And frankly, Ham's been punished enough if he's seen his dad naked and drunk.
Well, he did. I think that maybe the punishment was because he tried to cover him up. You know, cover up his fucking shame and be like, you know what, old man? How about you're not fucking, you know, totally drunk and naked while we're trying to, you know, just survive for the next 40 days with all these smelly animals on our boat.
Yeah, right.
And how do you think people would have responded by, you know, sort of like, let's pretend I go to this fundamentalist school and they talk about Noah's Ark and I say, well, the story of Noah is actually a ripoff of the Akkadian story of Upnapishtim, which is itself a ripoff of the Sumerian story of Ziusudra. How would they feel about this exactly? What would be their response, if you could just guess?
Well, I fantasize about this all the time. If I could just go back in time and stir shit up there, what would have happened? And, I mean, I could have been spanked, and eventually I would have been expelled for causing trouble. But what they would actually say in response to that is, no, what those other myths prove is that this is a real thing that really happened. There really was a worldwide flood that really did destroy all the world, and there really was a guy with a boat. So for them, those other myths, they actually say that's more evidence that we're right.
That's interesting. So they just double down.
Yeah.
They're like, well, you see, there are other myths, so therefore it must have happened.
Yeah, exactly. It really happened. But our version is the true one, but not the other ones.
Right. The other versions, the far older versions that are almost twice as old as this one, are the wrong ones.
Yeah.
Did anyone ever try the whole, you know, devil kind of is trying to trick you thing? Or how much mention of the devil do they sort of like normally have in the curriculum? Was the devil brought up at any time there was some kind of problem? Do you remember any of that?
Yeah. Unbelievably, the devil is in especially the materials on church history, but he comes up in other things too. I think he comes up in the world history course somewhere, but in church history all the damn time. They're just like, the devil is just constantly being mentioned. As like, every time something bad happens to Christians anywhere, they're like, yeah, the devil was doing this. And when they're talking about, you know, how in the 17th and 18th 19th centuries, people started to look at the Bible critically and go, hang on, this isn't inerrant, that was the devil.
So the devil is probably the most popular character in their history. He just keeps popping in and out anytime something is really happening. It's like, well, the devil was right there.
Yeah, the devil's awesome. I can't really get my head around the fact that the devil, depending on what point they're trying to make, is either a defeated enemy or really almost as powerful as God.
Yeah, you have to kind of wonder what his relationship is. I mean, it's kind of like in the book of Job, right, where he sort of like shows up and he's hanging out with God, and God's like, hey, what you been up to? And he's like, I was just walking around the earth checking things out. And you kind of are like, is God allowing that to happen? Like, what's happening here? Like, are they buddies? Because let me tell you something, I don't have bets with people that are not my friends. So, yeah, that's kind of weird. The whole relationship with God and the devil. Did they talk about the book of Job much? Because here's the funny thing, actually, what I found from the book of Job itself, is that the entire book up until probably about chapter 36 or 38, when God finally shows up, is probably one of the best indictments against God that I've ever read in my life. Like, the entire time, Job's like, yeah, you know, atheists or godless people, they don't get punished. They don't fucking, you know, die. And good people like me who've never sinned, we get fucking crushed in the dust and treated like shit. And then when God finally shows up,
good Christian right politician with slogans like that.
And then when God finally shows up, his answer to Job's question is like, were you there when I created the earth, bitch? And it's like, what are you supposed to say to that? No. I guess you're super powerful, so that answers all my questions. But, you know, even if you read the rabbinical kind of like commentary, because, you know, Jews love to endlessly talk about the Bible, even if there's things about it that is kind of upsetting, they're just like, well, maybe that's just kind of a way of just you know, saying that God also needs to be just and yada, yada, yada. But in truth, you're just like, every single one of the things that Job says about God that is unfair and shitty is never answered. Never.
Right. It's interesting. No, especially from the type of Christianity I was in, believed that God didn't want anyone to suffer ever. Now, it's quite difficult to square that with reality, but believe me, we tried. But one of the things that, or certainly God didn't want Christians to suffer ever, you know. So, and by Christians, we included Job as kind of pre-Christian. So we kind of ignored the book of Job quite hard. I knew guys that would had these arguments that I thought were amazing that proved that, in fact, the book of Job was all about God being awesome. But really, it was a bit of a problem because it really contradicted a lot of what we believed.
It seems like almost the, you know, like the one book that just takes the time to stick it to God. And like, even though at the end, I suppose that everyone who's God fearing is like, well, God's super powerful. He can do whatever the fuck he wants. End of story. But it doesn't remove the fact that you're just saying like, he was kind of a dick.
Yeah. And there are other things. I mean, Ecclesiastes is a very different picture of God to the one that's in other parts of the Bible. And then the book of Esther doesn't actually mention God. He's not in it. So it's really fascinating now that I'm kind of looking at this sensibly from a point of view of, okay, so what is this book that we call the Bible? What is it really? And you realize it's a bunch of different people's completely different ideas about God. And it becomes interesting when you start to think of it like that, instead of trying to see it as this, like you talk about how crappy the Bible is, and it is crappy if you're expecting it to be the inerrant word of God that we should all live our lives by. Then it becomes this horrible tool of oppression in the hands of the religious right. But if you think of it as a bunch of historical documents that can tell us stuff about certain people's beliefs in the ancient world, and you think of it that way, then it kind of becomes fascinating. It's like, man, what were these ancient kind of cults? What did they think? They believed some crazy stuff.
Yeah, and one of the things that I kind of regret is, if I had my way, like, I think that when I first started Bible Stories, I should have probably, like, instead of saying, oh, I'm going to take a year to write it, I should have probably taken two. Because what I'd really love to do is kind of not only rewrite the stories, but also kind of explain in detail, well, you know, what exactly is going on? What is the history of this particular book? Because there are certain things about it, and these are not things that are talked about very often. In fact, this is why, you know, it probably, if I would have written the Bible Stories the way that I really wanted to, it would have taken a lot longer. And I'll give you a good example. Is like, I'm sure you've heard of who the Samaritans are, right? That sounds familiar, like the Good Samaritan. Well, the thing about Samaritans is that they claimed that they were the original Jews, and that the Bible itself was written by individuals who had kind of returned from the Babylonian exile. And that their entire story, the story of Moses, even Genesis, is really the result of all of the influence of Babylonian culture. And it was the Samaritans who were the true Jews. Now, in that sense, it's kind of mind-blowing when you think about the fact that maybe Judaism as it is now, or even when it was then, was actually a manufactured religion, a pagan religion, if you want, that kind of took elements of their own exodus in the hands of Babylonians, and then included all of these other elements, the Egyptian exodus, and all of this is really just a reflection of that one event written far after the fact. And then all of a sudden you realize, well, were the Samaritans actually legitimate, sort of like carriers of what would have been Judaism had it not been for the success of, say, the Roman Empire and their inclusion of, you know, Christianity and so on and so forth. And you're just like, these are, you know, this is an interesting discussion, difficult to actually square, because who's really going to admit that, you know, modern day Jews are nothing but pagan Babylonians?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's so interesting, isn't it? And certainly the Genesis myth makes so much more sense when you compare it to other myths that were around at the time, and Egyptian myths and stuff. And it really does look like they were taking the form of what were standard creation myths in the area at the time, but going, well, no, we don't believe in all your gods. We believe in one God. And that's really what Genesis chapter 1 is just saying. It's like, there's only one God. That's that's it. It's like,
well, actually, maybe chapter two, because chapter one is like, there's a plurality. It's like, let us make him. Yeah.
I'm getting, see, you, I love how you know the Bible better than I do. I should brush up, because it's making me look inauthentic.
It's okay. It's okay. Like I said, I'm rewriting it. So
I thought Let Us was chapter two, and it was chapter one that had the
story. No, it's the other way around. In chapter one is sort of like, you know, the order of things kind of changes, which is why I'll tell you one thing. This is the unfortunate thing about Bible stories. The hardest thing is that when the first chapter is, or at least the first few chapters, is the most challenging, because it begins by saying the same story twice in a completely different manner. So it's just like, oh, you know, like whenever you start a book, you want to start strong. Yeah. And it's really hard to start strong when you're just like, okay, here we go again. But now things are different.
Yep, two different versions.
Well, okay, so before we go, because, you know, obviously there's still plenty to talk about, which is why we're going to have you on the show again to talk about different...
Does that mean topics. I passed the audition?
Now, well, you know, I haven't made that decision. Well, it's not my decision to make, I'll be honest with you. There's going to be anybody who listens to this, they're going to be able to, you know, dictate to some degree, I liked him or I didn't like him. And, you know, there's probably going to be plenty of girls that love your British accent. So you already got that going for you.
I love you too, girls. I love you.
Remember, Johnny's a little bit, you know, he was a little bit stunted, and he needs your support. And by support, I mean, you know, you're sending him pictures of yourselves naked.
I'm not stunted in all areas.
I just meant emotionally, all right? I'm not trying to sort of like paint you as some kind of prepubescent boy here. I'm just saying that, you know, like you were late into the, you know, rational game here.
I have to make up for lost time.
Exactly, exactly. And, but you know, as we trail off in the show, I'm going to be including one of your songs.
Yes.
So that will be one way in which people can appreciate your excellence, because the whole thing is, in my quest, as I said, for the next generation, I'm still looking for young people that have fucking skills, and I would say that you have some skills, sir. So I'm endorsing you. But ultimately, if people, you know, don't like you and reject you, the hammer will come down. But I have a lot of, you know, faith and confidence that they will appreciate, especially as we said before, you have already participated in the, you know, in this activism thing. You've already put information out there, which, you know, some of it, which we've now listened, and hopefully you're going to keep bringing us more. I, you know, as often as you can come up with some original creative material, you can come on the show.
And hell yeah.
There you go. See, he's already happy about that. So if you guys are listening to the show and you like Johnny, we've got links to his stuff. You're going to be, you know, you're probably even listening to this song trailing off as I yappity yap, and go to his site. Tell me that you love him and that you want him to be, you know, one of the new generation of good atheists. And if he makes it in the new logo that I'm designing, I'll be drawing a cartoon version of you.
Yes.
So, awesome. but I need at least, you know, five or six people that approve of you before that happens. And because, you know, in the world of the internet, that means like 500 people approve of you. That's how it works with comment sections. Trust me. I'm like, if the average show gets one comment and gets downloaded 5,000 times, five comments is a big deal.
Yep.
So that's what we're waiting for. Five comments that say, Johnny Scaramanga, please come back on the show. We want you to be a new generation good atheist. You did a great fucking job. And like I said before, I'm endorsing him. And, yes. And
there
you
go. People that read my blog to send you mail. So you're going to have a lot of first time commenters.
Yeah, I'm wary of that. It better be some fucking, you know, there's got to be a few, veterans that are telling me that you're all good. But other than that, you know, I'm going to be having I think next week or 2 weeks from now, I have another person who's trying to audition, if you want, for some of the next generation. My hope is that eventually, you know, like every once a month, maybe I have a rotation of a whole bunch of other, you know, the next generation of good atheists that have a whole bunch of material that they want to talk about. Because for fuck's sake, this is a huge platform. You guys should be able to use this. And like I said, man, atheism, it's got to be put in the hands of other people. I mean, I think I, after 320 shows or some odd, I think I've probably said my piece. I think it's time for some new voices, biatches.
I'm bored of you.
What a coincidence, I'm bored of me. Okay, with that, my name is Jacob Forte.
My name is Johnny Scaramanga.
Have a good atheist day, everybody.